Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that was Fathead Newman. David Fathead Newman was born on this day in 1933, and Hard Times is the piece you heard. One of the greats, Fathead Newman, born on this day in 1933. So more of his music and links to that will be on our website at steinershow.org. You listen to the Mark Steiner Show. Pardon me. You listen to the Mark Steiner Show that's brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information, www.mecu.com, or you can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, at the top of our webpage. We're switching gears now to a different roundtable, a roundtable looking at the events affecting us here locally. We are joined once again by Krishana Davis, who is reporter for Baltimore Sun Media Group, where she covers news, politics, and more from Harford County. Good to see you back in the studio again.
Good to see you again, Mark.
Jeff Singer's with us, founder and former executive director of healthcare for the homeless, now an instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and gadfly and troublemaker across town. Good to have you in the studio, Jeff.
We try. Thank you, Mark.
Greg Klein joins. Oh, Greg's not here yet. He's coming in a minute. Reverend Meredith Moyes joins us by phone. She's an ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, one of the first black women ordained within the old Catholic Church here in Baltimore. She's currently a climate organizer and works for environmental change. And Meredith, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, all. Good morning. Thank you, Mark.
How's your car?
Oh, man, when it's bleeding oil, it's bleeding oil.
I'm so sorry to hear that. We're looking forward to seeing you, but we'll see you soon.
Yes.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can also log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, your thoughts on local issues of the day. We'll go around the room here talking about a number of things and want to hear what our panel wants to talk about as well, not just what I want to talk about, what you want to talk about at 410-319-8888 when it comes to things facing our city and our state. Let me begin with the passing of Gregory Kane. Gregory Kane had been a guest on the show since the beginning. And I was hoping to have some tape of Gregory. We didn't have it ready for today, but Gregory was also a lot of that tape that we have. You know, the UMBC has taken the Steiner Show archives. So a lot of our older archives are at UMBC, and we're going to try to get some of those pieces out here for days like this because he and I may have disagreed on some things here and there down the line. And we did. But he's a man who danced to his own drummer, so to speak, a man who said what he thought. People kind of unfairly call him an Uncle Tom and more, but he wasn't. He was a deep thinker. He was his own thinker. He had his conservative viewpoint, and a viewpoint by people standing up for themselves in the community. He was very bright and very witty. And he always supported our work here on the Mark Steiner Show and always supported me and all the trials and tribulations this show has gone through over the years. And I always supported him. I thought he fought cancer bravely. Came on the show when he was still in chemotherapy, lost his hair, lost the weight. His wife drove him over here. He did the show. He wanted to do more of the shows. He just didn't have the strength to do it. And I just want to say I really mourn his passing. He was a really good guy, I think treated shabbily by the Sun when they let him go, but he was a good man. He was, as we would say in the community I grew up in, he was a mensch. He was a guy who knew what friendship meant and knew what honesty meant, and just farewell, Gregory Kane. Just want to share that with you because I just think we had to say something about a good friend who passed away, and his memorial service will be happening sometime in the next month, I believe. His wife's going to put on, and clearly we will be there, and we'll be talking to them and remembering Gregory Kane, and one day we'll get those archives out, and we will play some of his voice in the air so we can keep that around. So, good to have you all here with us in the studio. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join this conversation. Where do we want to begin? So much to talk about, so little time. Let me ask this one question of you all, and this is a state thing, and I know that I know that Greg, on the Republican side of the partisan divide, that people are making great hay of this, but I think questions should be asked, and they are very complex questions about what has happened to the health care exchange in Maryland, why it's such a disaster. When we started so early to get this off the ground, one of the first states in the union, because we wanted to be at the head of the curve, and there were all kinds of reports that were done in the especially the Daily Record. Brian Sears kind of talked about this early, where the company that was given the contract, Maximus, to restore the issue is also a company that is owned by a company that gave a lot of money to the Democratic Governors Conference when Martin O'Malley was its chairman, that has that also has a stake in getting as many people as they can to join their healthcare system. They're done without kind of a large oversight because the Board of Estimates decided to allow that to go through. I mean, I think that, and I'm not, and so something went wrong. And I'm not saying this is something where people should be indicted and sent to prison and go on trial, but I think the people of the state deserve to understand what went wrong, at the very least, just what went wrong. What do you all think?
Meredith.
I know it
I
is.
I think that for me, this has real-life implications. I have friends and family trying to get onto the website, and it doesn't work, and they need health insurance. Somebody was asleep at the switch. Someone needs to be held responsible. And I think that in all of the din of this, and some people trying to play gotcha with whoever, people are forgetting the real-life people who need this and are not getting the services that they need.
Jeff, and then we're right over here. You were making head movements as I was saying this, but go ahead.
The history of the PPACA, the Obamacare, is fraught with all sorts of issues like this. But in Maryland, yes, it's been very, very problematic. I looked up the report about minimizing the numbers of people who are supposed to be enrolled by the end of March, and the state had an original projection of about 260,000, and they've now brought that down to 150,000 or so, including Medicaid. And the title of the report from the Hilltop Institute, which is a contractor with the state, is New Mexico Projections for the Affordable Care Act. So just from the very start, you knew there was a problem. The however much it is, 130 million, 230 million, saw differing estimates recently, I would say that's 100% wasted dollars. The whole design of the Affordable Care Act is built on a model that maximizes the profits for insurance companies, minimizes access to care. No one should have to go through 8 sessions on the telephone and computer in order to have health care. They don't do that in civilized countries. But we do that here. In part, it's a way to keep people from getting health care. And in part, it's to make sure that there's profits everywhere in the system, everywhere. Because the $230 million that Maryland's going to spend actually goes into the pockets of private contractors for the most part. Some state employees are paid through that. But mostly it's the people who are building the exchange, the computer people, the IT people, those folks, and the insurance companies. That's who gets this money. It doesn't provide health care to people. In fact, the insurance system itself doesn't provide health care to people. So I think from the beginning we had a flawed program.
I have a feeling you think it's flawed from a different perspective, Greg.
Well, we've written a lot about this, obviously,
have,
at Red
yes.
Maryland. And I think it's a kind of a case study of what's wrong with government trying to do some of these things, and particularly what's really wrong with the way Maryland does a lot of things. When you talk about the folks who are getting all of this money, the reporting that we're seeing as we're digging in more and more, even though the General Assembly is kind of frustrating actually having some sort of investigation, is that these contractors are people who have close connections with the O'Malley-Brown administration. They're people who they've done deals with before with the red light cameras that don't work in the city and other things. There isn't the normal process of procurement that was gone through to get all of this money out. And it's just endemic of kind of the failures that we have in this state because of the kind of crony relationships that our state leaders have with folks who are getting all of this money and the way that it's being implemented. It's an enormous thing for government to try to do, and it's difficult to do in the first place, which is one of the reasons why those of us on the right have said it isn't something government's going to be very good at doing, and it hasn't been. But it's complicated here in a state like Maryland, where the people who are closely connected, and some of those names have come out and more will as we go along, have been able to game the system. And the product shows that, you know, and the real life consequences are not just the people not getting the services they want, but that $100 million in taxpayer money that we've all paid that I think has been wasted, and not only wasted, but put in the pockets of people who have close political connections. I think it is important also because the guy who was tasked to run this is running for governor now, and he's, you know, getting competition from both sides of the aisle. And I think for that reason as well, getting to the bottom of what happened is going to be very, very important.
Mark, I think overall, Marylanders deserve transparency. They want to make sure that, you know, what they're putting their tax dollars into makes sense and is being used effectively. I think one of the interesting things about this, though, is that nothing has really been done in this mass of a scale to help either with health care or any other issues that we have in America as a society. And so I wonder, you know, yes, we can always look at the back end and say what could have been done differently. But as far as the people who have been able to sign up and have been able to use it, I know that there are issues there. And, you know, Marylanders want answers. And Meredith was very right about the very real implications of kind of what's happening here. But I think that that shouldn't negate the fact that there are people signing up. There is a lot of push and momentum with it moving forward. And so, yes, some things are going to have to be done to fix it on the back end. But this mass, large scale of a project, as much as I hear people talking about it, I don't know if it could have been executed flawlessly.
Probably not flawlessly, but I wonder, do we think, before we move on to another topic here, do we think that that there should be an investigation, not to kind of, I don't think, to say that there was any kind of legal wrongdoing necessarily, but to find out what went wrong so it doesn't go wrong again?
Absolutely.
I mean that's to me is the bottom line issue here. I mean, we can argue, I think, as you were doing, Jeff, we can argue over, you know, what kind of healthcare system we need to have. The reality, this was a healthcare system that was put in front of America, that America had to grapple with. Something went wrong here. It didn't go wrong in California. Didn't go wrong in Kentucky, which is a state that is about the same size, maybe a little smaller than Maryland population-wise. I should have looked that up before we went on the air. But something clearly didn't happen here that happened right somewhere else. And I think part of it might be political because the man who is in charge is the man who's running for governor.
And one is curious as to how much work he actually did, given that right. No one can even find emails that he sent to the people who were operationally in charge. So that's curious, too. Also, in fairness, I'll point out that under the Ehrlich administration, Maximus – company that you mentioned, Mark,
right.
Was given a big contract to work on health care issues and Medicaid enrollment in Maryland. And I must say, as a business owner, I had an enormous amount of trouble with them. But
and I think that part of it is Meredith, you were about to say what? Then I'll say about it before we move on.
Okay. I was going to say that it would behoove the lieutenant governor to be as transparent as possible. It would only help him. But I think that, like, on the outside looking in and looking at all the reports that I've seen about this on TV and in the print, it really looks shady. And I think that one of the things that the people of Maryland deserve is transparency in government. And it would only help him if he would just at least look like he was commissioning a report. I'm responsible. The buck stops here. Here's what we found out, and here's what we're going to do going forward, and not just, well, we're going to correct the problem and move forward. We need details. We need details. There are lives that are depending on getting insurance. We need details.
And I think that one of the things that Jeff was saying is that really important, and folks like to hear what you think at 410-319-8888, which is that whether it's Martin O'Malley or Bob Ehrlich, Republican or Democrat, inside of the governor's mansion or anybody else's governor's mansion, that groups like Maximus wield a lot of power because they have a lot of money to throw around to get contracts and whatever else they want in the state of Maryland. It don't always serve the best interest of the people of the state. I think that's part of the
some of the underlyings of what's going on.
Right. You saw my hand going on there. Thank you, Chris.
and that's why the transparency is so important and why those state procurement laws following them is so important as well. And that didn't quite happen this time.
It did not happen this time. And those things need to be called into question. And I want you to be able, folks, to bring up whatever you like to bring up during the course of this conversation, what really grabs you here. I know that that Krishana can't comment on what's going on with the Baltimore City paper because she works for the paper that's buying it, but...
Darn, I thought we would get the inside.
No, I don't think so.
No scoops here.
No scoops there. but I think that we'll only can see how that plays out. I will say a disclaimer. You know, we have a partnership with the Baltimore City paper, the Mark Steiner Show does, and so let me put that on the table right now. But I think that we all are waiting to see. We don't know what the reality is going to be. But I think that every time that we take another independent piece of media out, I think there's a danger in what we have the right to learn on things that City Paper has done over the years really well, besides covering the cultural scene in Baltimore, is having investigative reporters full-time who do a job that very few other outlets have done. Will that continue to take place? We don't know.
Yeah, Ed Erickson and Van Smith are two of the best investigative journalists in Baltimore, and I read the City Paper every day, every week, not for the culture as much as for the news. So I'd hate to hear their voice silenced.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things that most of the many large newspapers have done is cut back on the amount of money and time it takes to do real investigative reporting, to get underneath
Absolutely.
Things. And that's one of the things the City Paper has done so well for all of us.
Yeah, I mean, look, we at Red Maryland have a relationship with the Baltimore Sun. We have a blog, baltimoresun.com/redmaryland. But, you know, we do a lot of investigative reporting, and one of the reasons that we do that kind of stuff is because we're not seeing it done elsewhere, and it would be sad to see an outlet doing it, whatever perspective, whatever location they are, not doing that anymore, because we need more of it, not less. Absolutely.
I'm concerned as an avid reader of the City Paper that we're going to see like this corporate media stuff be thrown into this edgy, kitschy type, definitely Baltimore flavored paper. And I'm also concerned that the level of the way in which the paper is written, the quality of the content and the editorial goes down. I mean, no shade to the Sun, but I've heard that it was written on a grade school level. So does that also mean that now the City Paper editorial will kind of mirror that? I mean, there are a whole lot of implications for those of us who do want independent news, who do want the kind of meaty journalism that allows people to have conversations that are well-informed and well-thought-out. I'm very concerned about this purchase. Also because the Sun was supposedly, you know, in talks with the Koch brothers, their parent company. So if that deal goes through, does this mean that, you know, the Koch brothers grab all of this up? There are a lot of implications here.
410-319-8888 is the number here. There was an editorial that you commented on that the mayor wrote, Jeff Singer, in Sunday's paper yesterday.
There was indeed. There was indeed. The mayor was criticizing those who criticize the city, including the Red Maryland.
Yeah, my colleague Brian Griffiths wrote a piece in Friday's paper that obviously got the mayor's attention.
And we need to know more about the city's actual accomplishments. The mayor mentioned a few, but I'm not sure that the data and experience support much of what she mentioned. She did say that we don't sugarcoat our problems in Baltimore, and I would say, in fact, we look to sugar daddies to solve those problems rather than sugarcoating them. I did notice that of the 55 rec centers that existed when the mayor took office, there are only 35 today, which is a rather large decline in services.
One thing I like to know about, since you raised that, let me raise an issue before you think about this. When it talks about Baltimore City now for just a moment, before we go back to the state and some of the issues facing the state legislature, which I do want to get to. When the mayor was on this program for 10 or 12 minutes on the day that she gave her State of the City address, one of the things she talked about was putting money into two things. Now, I'm going to talk about this in terms of what priorities are and what we think about what should be done, and maybe I'm making too much of this, but let me throw it out there on the table. One of the things they talked about in the administration, they want to put money into the centers for kids who are taken up off the street because they were out after curfew. And others have kind of responded that how much will that really cost? If you're going to fund these centers, if you're going to open, turn the lights on, pay the electric bill, and pay staff to be there, how much does that cost? And would that money be better spent just being put into rec centers? They keep them open longer and have actually people there working with children out of our rec centers. What's the priority there? And the other one was something that every law enforcement official on the show so far, before the week before last and the week before that, that seemed to say, no, there's nothing to worry about here. And maybe there's not, but that we are going to have a new special command post in Baltimore that will have 24/7 operations to be able to put enough cameras in to watch every community in Baltimore 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And my question to the commission was, are we that crime-ridden all over Baltimore that we have to watch ourselves 24/7? What is that going to cost? And what does that mean, given everything else that's going on in terms of collecting data on human beings in our society, as opposed to where money might be invested in this city? So I'm curious what we think about that.
I think, to me, the most concerning thing seems to be the 24/7 surveillance. I think that the idea of Big Brother constantly watching you as you're walking around Baltimore, for many of the citizens who aren't committing crimes, is disturbing, and they're going to want to know why my money is being allocated that way. I don't know if that's the best way for the city to combat crime. I think that the blue light cameras do work in some areas, and they've seen that they've been able to, you know, find out who the criminals are who are committing acts. But I don't think that's the best way to use resources, and I'm not sure that most of the citizens of Baltimore would agree with that.
I think it's an egregious violation of our privacy, and for the record, do cameras really stop crime? I know they watch people commit crimes, but I've also heard that a lot of the blue cameras don't work, and that when they do work, it's grainy, and who can figure out who's doing what? So can we refine the process? And if we're going with the camera situation, the speed cameras didn't work well. So can we fix what we have first before we talk about expanding these privacy violations? I'm not too sure about that. I have some real concerns about that.
Well, I think there's a real question as to whether the, you know, expanding the camera use will, in fact, you know, in a city police department that's so built on statistics and driving that, it would seem that they should be able to prove that that's actually a more efficient use of resources, that they actually do result in lower crime. You know, if it really did have an impact, maybe people would be comfortable with it. I think the privacy concerns are obvious. And the concerns are understandable.
It doesn't get your libertarian hackles up a little bit?
Well, I'm not as libertarian as some. It does get those hackles up, to be sure, and especially if it doesn't end up solving the real, you know, interminable crime problems. You know, the one thing that I think my colleague Brian Griffiths, when he was criticizing the mayor, was, you know, we need leadership in the city that is focused on fixing the problems in the city, not going on Meet the Press to talk about, you know, what the Republicans in Congress are doing and looking to their next step. So however that manifests itself, that's really where the leadership needs to be. These crime problems continue to be interminable, and I don't know whether this project or another one, just throwing more money at it, is the solution, especially when we're not really looking at ways to improve the business environment here, to grow the economy in the city and bring jobs here, which I think we all would agree is really what is needed the most.
Yes, I'd say the single best investment that the city could make to reduce crime would be to fight to legalize drugs and make them a public health issue rather than a criminal issue. And we would see, if the city actually had a focused effort to do that, we would see a dramatic decrease in people arrested and locked up and their lives disrupted. It would change the landscape dramatically.
Well, I do want to get to legalization of drugs in a moment, because of what Colorado came out with today, saying now that they think that there'll be well over $100 million worth of revenue coming into the state with legalization of marijuana in Colorado. I want to get to that thought, because that's being debated in the state legislature now.
I just wanted to make one point. Commissioner Batts made a really big deal about putting boots on the ground a few months ago and having officers out of their cars and being around in communities and cities. And so if that sounds like almost a contradiction to what this new surveillance system that they're going to be putting up. They seem like the ideas are not gelling together with me, because if you're going to put money into putting more officers out in the street, why do you need these cameras to complement that?
Exactly.
Yeah, I guess there's some disturbing aspects to this camera issue for me as well. Just the idea that we need this kind of surveillance, we need to put that kind of money in our police department. We need it done other ways. But I really do want to know what the cost is going to be for implementing these new centers to take children off the street, and whether that means that poor families, which we're talking about, I don't think we're going to go to Roland Park and see a kid walking down the street at 1 in the morning to his house who's 16 getting arrested. I don't think that's going to happen. They may do that once and say, Steve, we did do it, but I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they're talking about serious fines for poor families whose kids are out. I mean, there's some real issues here. What is the money being spent, and what would happen if that money was infused into our parks and rec system?
Here, here.
We don't know the answers to that. We don't know. Yeah. We don't see where the money is.
I think it'll be interesting to see the stats of how many children actually are being picked up on the daily basis.
They're
and
very
really,
low, actually.
Right, and released. And it's not to say that those children aren't important and that they shouldn't be picked up and resources shouldn't be spent there, but I don't know if there is enough children in Baltimore that are experiencing, you know, this kind of absent family issue that they're out that time of night that causes for a big-scale center like this.
Folks, what you think? 410-319-8888 is part of the answer in front of the state legislature this year. We'll talk more about that in the coming weeks, the legalization of marijuana. At the very tip of the legalization debate in this state. Should it happen, Colorado's now saying that they're going to be getting vastly more amounts of money from the legalization of marijuana in Colorado than they expected. And what are your thoughts? Do you think it should be legalized? 410-319-8888. We'll be right back with that and more. And our panel, we're going to go out here with There Stands the Glass by Webb Pierce, who singer-songwriter, guitarist, who died on this day in 1991.
Brother, I'm on my way. I'm wondering where you are tonight. Oh, oh,
oh, oh, oh. Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner with our local roundtable here, and there's a number of things, places we can go to in the next half an hour, and we've had a couple of ideas here from our guests, which is the proposed 70-mile-an-hour speed limit. It was one idea, which could be an interesting thing to touch upon, and some other places to go, as well as your information now out there with the University of Maryland. Does everybody know your Social Security number? We're here with Krishana Davis, reporter for the Baltimore Sun Media Group, covering politics and news from Harford County. Jeff Singer, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless, instructor at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. Greg Klein is an attorney, co-founder and contributing editor for Red Maryland, hosts the Conservative Refuge podcast, and co-hosts Red Maryland Radio. And the Reverend Meredith Moyes is with us, ordained minister, writer, community activist, teacher, one of the first black women ordained in the Old Catholic Church here in Baltimore, and is a climate organizer and environmental activist in our community as well. 410-319-8888. Barry, you're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Barry.
And to your honorable guest. My question to you is, if we have all of these resources that are being cut to our youth, what happened to the PAL programs?
Well, the PAL programs were came in under, why am I blocking the police commissioner's name, was guesting the show all the time back in the 90s, came out of California. Where did my brain go? Anyway, they were started by one police commissioner here. And then the next police commissioner came in, decided we didn't need the PAL centers anymore, that a policeman's job was not to work in rec centers with young people. A policeman's job was to patrol the street. So they got rid of PAL, which many people thought was a real problem. And one of the things that kind of opened the doors to having police have better relations with community and with kids was the fact that officers were taking their own time to work in these centers, to work with kids playing basketball, boxing, talking, just being there as human beings. And I think that helped humanize the police, and it helped young people and police get to know each other on a different level, which I think was really important. But that was decided that it was no longer a viable thing for our officers to do.
Commissioner Frazier.
Thank you. He's the one who instituted that. And I think then it was taken out. And I think that he was also the one who wanted to bring David Kennedy in to Baltimore City for ceasefire. And ceasefire was roundly criticized by the Governor Martin O'Malley, pushed David Kennedy out. But now it seems as though we're talking about ceasefire coming back, mm-hmm. which yeah. is an alternative way of addressing crime. What do we think about that? Something we raised. We'll come back to marijuana just a second. Jamila, you're going to talk about legalizing drugs. We're going to get your call next. Let's talk about that for a moment. What are your thoughts, Meredith?
I think that there does need to be a program in which people are constructively engaging some of the, I don't want to say seedier elements, but I'll just say the elements that are you know, precipitating and causing this violence. I think it's important. I would like, if ceasefire really does come in to do this, because I know the mayor talked about this in her State of the Union, I would love to see church partners get involved. I would love to see schools get involved. I would love to see the community mobilized and not just something come in and, you know, say this is what we're going to do. This is a community effort, and a lot of this stems down from the breakdown of the family. And, you know, do we repair this from the outside, or do we repair this from the inside, or is it a mixture of the two? But something definitely has to be done. We have to start talking to these folks who are within our communities who are doing these things. They're not coming from the outside. It's not an invading force. Like, these are people that live right next door. These are people that we grew up with. They went to various high schools throughout the city. So we really need to really get a handle on the mindset, mental health counseling. Are they coming with mental health counseling? Because that's important, too. I mean, so, most of the city, I feel like, has PTSD over this. So I would love to see the plan, the rollout, what exactly is going to be done and how people are going to be mobilized in this effort.
The whole idea of Operation Ceasefire, that could bring a lot of other elements to it, as Meredith was pointing out, but the whole idea of Operation Ceasefire with David Kennedy is that it brings the police and community together, along with churches, counselors, and other people who identify the bad actors in the community, the ones that everybody knows in the community who are doing most of the serious crime, brings them into situations that we know who you are, you're here, but what we're going to do is we're going to help you find a different way to live your life. The community's going to wrap their arms around you and help you, but if not, the community's going to wrap their arms around and push you into prison. And it's a different way of kind of addressing issues of violence in communities, that if that was really implemented in a serious way in Baltimore, could be a very positive thing.
Yes.
If that could happen, if it did happen.
I mean, I think I look back to Pell Centers, and I am a product of Pell Centers, and I guess I'm showing my age a little bit with that, but I attended the one at
so
Montebello.
How young you are, you mean.
Yeah. And at Hamilton. I definitely would say that there was a, I mean, we understood officer friendly. And so when they came into neighborhoods in the summertime, you know, you spoke and you went up to that car and there wasn't a fear or a barrier there. And I think that could be implemented, is basically on a larger scale with ceasefire. And so I think that it would be really interesting to see if, you know, it could be really implemented in Baltimore. I think that it will also push out a lot of the stop snitching ideas that we have in the city, because if there is a community alliance with, you know, the police department, and people are continuing to show that they're not going to abide by the laws, they are going to commit crimes, then the community can stand up and say, you know, we already have this alliance, we have this voice, this is what we're going to do to make sure these people are not continuing to terrorize our communities.
Yeah, I think it's something along those lines of also thinking about bringing PAL back, but also the idea of doing community mediation and restorative justice programs to create a whole different aura and model of how to deal with crime and violence in our community could be brought in if it's allowed to happen that way.
Could I observe that another ACE Sun reporter, Yvonne Wenger, reported 6 months ago, and I have not examined the city's budget recently myself, but that the city currently spends about $10 million a year on rec centers and $330 million a year on police. And I think part of our problem is this imbalance.
410-319-8888, your thoughts. And Jamila, you're on the air.
How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore has grown for so many names and so many elevated stages that these generations have gone through. you know, I'm a migrator here. I've been here since I was 3 years old. I'll be 50 years old this year. And I do see the problem here in Baltimore. The problem is that, one, police officers take too much authoritative positions on the younger generations. And the younger generations, they do go out and get their recreational marijuana. Marijuana is actually medication, a tree, medication. But because the pressure of the children not having direct guidance, they don't know. There's a book out there, the Native American book, that talks about all the leaves from the trees that has medicinal reasons and purposes of being used, even down to the eucalyptus leaves. So if these people was able to get their intellect together properly, they would be able to see how to mix the eucalyptus leaves together and the marijuana, because now they got all these different names. We don't know what's going on. I don't know what's going on. And I don't even smoke it like that. I'm not a pothead. But I am in a melting pot of America, and I am a Blackfoot Indian, as well as a descendant of my ancestors. But predominantly, I'm a citizen. And when I smoke it, it gives me rest. I have back spasms. When I smoke it, it gives me the rest that I need, the journey I need to take on for my spirit, for my soul, to rest at peace. So now when you have children that's doing it every day, now you got to remember, you got some premature children out here. They was medicated for 3, 4, and 5 months at a time. My son lived for 10 months outside of my womb. And the body has a tendency to go into a progress period and a regress period.
Right.
When his 10th month came in the hospital, never reaching home from the hospital, everything collapsed. His mind, his brain deteriorated, his heart burst. Second stage pneumonia, and I was 5 months carrying. So, you know, Baltimore needs to really educate themselves a little bit more deeper than what they claim, that they need to keep putting these children in jail. Because jail ain't doing crap for them.
All right.
They need educating themselves, let alone to be able to educate them inside the institution. All you're doing is making them dykes and faggots.
Okay, Jamila, thanks so much for your thoughts. I appreciate being part of the show. No, we just have to move on here. But, I mean, but let's talk about the marijuana legislation, whether or not it should pass. But most likely will not pass in this session, though it's never been taken as seriously, I think, as a debate as it has now. Part of that is the push by one of our gubernatorial candidates, Heather Mazier, who has made this a push, but also is the push by LEAP and other organizations that are bringing this to the fore in ways that it has not done before on this program here on our Annapolis summit. The Senate President, Mike Miller, basically said, I support the legalization of marijuana. It's not going to happen this year, but he supports it. So something shifted. What do we think?
Krishana?
Let me go to Krishana this time first.
Well, I think that just as you look across the country, as other states have started to make headway in their conversations with marijuana, I think that in Maryland, we couldn't continue to have this conversation or couldn't continue to ignore the conversation because of the tons of different ramifications, especially some of the medical information that's come out and the push towards the legalization for medical usage. And then I think when you look at the criminal implications of it as well, I think that overall, you know, as a state, we couldn't continue to not talk about it, whether or not it's passed. But I think to continue to go down a path as, you know, each General Assembly session continues and to not talk about it or bring it to the forefront wasn't going to continue to sit well with most Marylanders.
Greg, what's your view on this? I haven't heard you say one word on marijuana. I want to hear what you think.
Well, I'm obviously, and we've talked about this before on the show, I'm opposed to marijuana legalization.
That's right. What am I saying? We had this huge conversation and debate together on the show. Go right ahead.
Yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
I think a lot of the proponents of this have been pouring, you know, all of their hopes and dreams in this idea that if we legalize marijuana, all of these problems are going to go away. We're still going to have, even if you legalize marijuana, we're still going to have serious drug problems and the war on drugs on the city streets of Baltimore. You're still going to have racial disparities in arrests for things like heroin, you know, crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. Those issues aren't going to go away. Those are still going to happen. I think one of the reasons why it's not going to happen this year is obviously political, but also there's a real wait-and-see attitude about places that have made it legal and what does that mean. You hear about the tax revenue But you're only now starting to hear about some of the other consequences that are going into this. I've written a lot about this at our Baltimore Sun blog, baltimoresun.com/redmarylandblog. You know, you're already starting to see in Colorado marijuana more and more prevalent in high schools. It's becoming more of a problem. The push towards legalization, there was a study done at the University of Michigan that found that 80% of high school seniors view marijuana as harmless. Now, whether you think it should be legal or not, the overwhelming medical evidence is that it's not harmless. I don't think it would be if you mixed it with eucalyptus, but it is a harm. You know, the AMA still views it as a harmful drug, and while they prefer it being handled as a public health issue, they still oppose its legalization because it is harmful. And the message that we're sending is, in this legalization argument, is that it's safe and that it's okay to use. It's medicinal. It provides palliative things, which in some cases for some folks with certain conditions, maybe it does. But a broad-based recreational use, that wouldn't be the case. And the fact is, even the push towards it, let alone actually doing it, is causing increased use among teens. It's the only drug in the National Institutes of Health survey that shows an increase among young people who are particularly vulnerable to especially the psychotropic effects long-term of even modest marijuana use at that age. That's going to be a problem if we make it legal. And I think it's one of the reasons why there's a real strong wait-and-see attitude on both sides of the aisle as far as making it legal in this state.
Jeff Singer.
Whatever problems may accompany the use of marijuana are, I think, eclipsed by the problems that we currently have with its illegality. The millions of people who are arrested or at least have contact with the criminal justice system. In New York City, stop and frisk was – a lot of it was about marijuana. I mean, it was racism is what it was, but their excuse for stopping people, and often the outcome was they would find some marijuana and therefore arrest somebody. If it were not illegal but treated as a public health issue, then we could – put our resources into those problems with prevention and treatment and education rather than putting them into jails and prisons and giving people a black mark on their lives forever. We have, you know, more than 2 million people in jail in the United States. How many are in jail because of something that was related to marijuana? Not that they got high and killed someone in their car, but that they were found with a small amount of it and arrested, and their lives are destroyed.
And I think those, you know, that's exactly the kind of thing where the numbers get exaggerated. In Maryland, you know, first-time marijuana possessors are not going to jail. In most cases, they're not getting a permanent mark on their record. There are reforms that can be made, and there's talk about, you know, lessening the penalties for first-time low-level users that can be made short of radical legalization across the board. And I think those are preferable to state leaders on both sides of the aisle.
So,
but I was going to say, I think many people who are pro pushing for the legalization would argue. I mean, I've sat in bail hearings many times, and the majority of them are it's the clogging up of the judicial system to deal with a lot of the marijuana use. And like I said, I've sat through bail hearings, and the vast majority of them, a lot of the kids do get a slap on the wrist. But I mean, to have to sit through that time in court with the judge and go through those resources, I don't know if that's, you know, worth it for a lot of the money that's being spent on marijuana.
Let me on the phone. Go ahead, Martha. I do want to get to the phones here. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm saying that legalization is important. I also think that we should be looking at the issues of substance abuse from a public health lens as opposed to a criminal lens. And as much as we talk about, oh, marijuana this and it's bad and all of that, we're not having the same conversation around alcohol and tobacco use among teens. As a former special education teacher, I'm telling you, a lot of kids were getting drunk before they were getting high, and they were getting drunk reaching into their parents' medicine cabinet for prescription narcotics.
And we're also seeing drug-wise, this is something that we're not tackling here, is the increased use of heroin by white suburban kids.
Yes.
In Maryland. That is,
and rural as well.
And especially in Harford problem. County, that's a really big issue out there.
In Baltimore County, a young woman OD'd in Baltimore County, northern Baltimore County, a young white girl who's 16 years old. And I think that this is, you know, that these kids aren't going to jail. doing heroin. The kids going to jail for heroin are still black kids, not white kids. 410-319-8888. Jay, your comment. Jay, welcome to the show. Jay, you there? 410-319-88. You got Jay hooked up or what? All right, I don't know what's happening. If you get back, they'll let me know, and Jay will come back to you. But coming back to where we left off here, I mean, so if we legalize marijuana in the state of Maryland, if that happened over the next 2 years, I mean, A, do we agree or disagree that it would cut down on the number of young African-American kids arrested for marijuana? It would. I mean, it may go up with – it may be possible that younger people will see it's not as much about why I shouldn't do this, just like they do with beer and alcohol and everything else. But that's the nature of our society. That stuff society has to deal with. The question is, should it be illegal? Should people be put in jail? Should people be arrested for marijuana? And even more so, from what you were saying earlier, Jeff Singer, should our entire way of looking at drugs, period, heroin, cocaine, whatever, be transformed?
Decriminalize all of it. I agree with Greg that just decriminalizing marijuana still leaves these very important issues of heroin, cocaine, crack. We need to decriminalize all of it and then redirect the billions of dollars involved, not just in the so-called war on drugs, but its sequel. We need to redirect those billions of dollars into helping our communities, creating employment opportunities, public health interventions. There's lots of productive things we could do rather than have lots of policemen, lots of jails, lots of courts.
410-319-8888. Go ahead, Greg, and then please, Krishna, jump in.
Well, it's refreshing that we're having a more honest discussion, that we're not just talking about marijuana legal, that we're really talking about legalization across the board as the ultimate goal. That's something that –
That's some people's ultimate. I don't think it's the ultimate goal of people who would want to legalize marijuana in the legislature. There may be something in this panel's goal, but it's not everybody's ultimate
goal. It's not what any elected officials say they want to do. But that is what the movement ultimately is. And the logical extension of it is just what we talked about. If that's what – you know, the same arguments would apply if your goal is – certainly if you legalize something that was illegal, you're going to have less people arrested and prosecuted for it. That's
right.
Obvious. Whether that's a good thing or not, you have to take into account the societal costs of increased usage. It disturbs me the ultimate vision of having drugs being widely available and legal and used as a source of revenue to fund big government programs that are supposed to help the community. That's not a brave new world that I think a lot of people are going to get very excited about.
Can I ask a question? Isn't there like an alcohol tax that the state just levied in the last 3 or 4 legislative sessions, where alcohol has a new tax and was raised, and that money's supposed to be going somewhere? So we do have a precedent of legalized drugs that are taxed by the government, and that money is supposed to go to something else. So we do have that precedent. And alcohol is a drug, and people do die of alcoholism. So I think that when we talk about this issue, we really need to have a holistic approach that is not just marijuana being bad or whatever. I mean, anything done to excess is bad. So that's another thing. And going to a ministerial standpoint, the root of human craving, when people crave stuff so much and they overuse it, you do have problems, regardless of whether it's marijuana, legalized or not legalized, whatever it is. It does cause havoc.
But I think as we also continue to talk about the debate of drugs, I think, you know, and young children and youth and high school students being involved, but a lot of what they're using are experimental drugs. They're synthetic drugs. It's become a really big deal in Harford County. They're using crocodile and hash and some of these other compounds and chemicals that they're putting together and they're experimenting with. So it's not just some of the traditional drugs that, you know, we think of when we think of drugs. It's not just your heroin and you know, crack and your marijuana. They're kind of at another step now, another layer. And so I think that is kind of becoming another issue in and of itself. Vaporizing alcohol has been a really big thing in Harford County, and they were explaining that, you know, you get you're drunk quicker, there's no calories, and you don't have the hangover. So that's why kids are really into it. But on the flip side, if you inhale too much of it, you can die instantly because it's too much.
I think here, this maybe the crux of the problem here, let's go to the phones, get this last comment in, so we can come back to this for a longer discussion. I think we'll have Greg back for that discussion and others as well. But I think that just like there's a very libertarian and conservative argument that whether it comes to guns or drugs, it's a larger societal issue we're facing, not the drug or the gun itself. The people made that argument a lot. I think that's an argument that has some merit, and we should really debate that one out. Let's see what our listener Jay has to say. Jay, you finally got through. You're on the air. Go ahead.
I think if you want to make the claim against marijuana plausible, you also have to run campaigns against, like you guys already said, alcohol. Our food supply has been proven that we as a society are more addicted to sugar than anything else.
It's true.
So I think that, I mean, if you're going to base a fight against marijuana off of it being harmful, quote unquote, then there's a lot of things that are just generally accepted that are very harmful to us. So I think the pros definitely outweigh the cons in the case of marijuana. And it's really, at the end of the day, it's really about money. It's about politics. And there's really there's no justification as to why we've been through the prohibition and now alcohol is legal. And here comes the same thing in the form of a different drug, if you want to call it. But, you know, we get over-the-counter drugs, we get right. prescription drugs, and all of these things are just as or more harmful to our body than the plant is.
Jay, I appreciate it. I'm glad you got through. Do we have time for one more quick call? Yes. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bill. We have very little time, so let me ask you to get right to the point, if I would. Apologize.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to reiterate, I guess, what the other caller was saying, you know, that marijuana is at least no more harmful than tobacco is. And certainly, you know, we have several hundred alcohol-related deaths per year. You know, they propose passes on our roads, et cetera. So how do you prohibit marijuana and at the same time allow products that are far more harmful? We have statistics to prove it, you know. I just don't understand.
Bill, I appreciate the call. We're going to come back to this for a longer discussion. I think that we also need to examine what is it about our societies and in this last two centuries where we find the need to get high all the time so quickly and get inebriated. That's part of the existence we have in this modern world. Why? Mm-hmm. And what role does that play? I want to thank Meredith Moyes for you being with us. Always great to have you on the air with us. Hope your car gets better.
Me and you both. Thank you, Mark.
Great client. Always good to have you here.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And you can catch him at Red Maryland and Red Maryland Podcasting and Red Maryland in the Sun. Jeff Singer, good. Always great to have you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
And Krishana Davis, and now at the Sun, good to have you in the studio as well.
Always good to see you, Mark.
Reminding you all on the way out of here that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org, or at the SteinerShow.org website. Click on the banner of the Maryland State Education Association. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Ennery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineers are Andre Melton. Our interns are Alex Boston and Matt Malice. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cut. You can hear the show again, find out information about our guests, what they write, where they write it, what they do, what they're talking about, by visiting us on the web at steinershow.org. You can podcast our shows. You can also go to iTunes now and podcast all of the Mark Steiner Show shows. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.